This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This entire vision is possible within a 5 to 6 year period of time. It can still happen, and that's what we've got to do. And sort of that's what freedom is about, making a choice. It's an imperfect choice to get to a much better future rather than doing nothing, which is what we're doing today.
Ask an environmentally aware friend of yours what they think about ethanol, and the response will probably be negative. Critics of this long-established biofuel will say that it's not a viable long-term replacement for petroleum-based fuels, that it competes with food production by diverting corn, that it's hard to store, doesn't travel well, or doesn't go to the more underlying problem of overconsumption. But how did most of us reach this conclusion? Who made these drawbacks to ethanol part of conventional wisdom? Today's guest on Sea Change Radio, filmmaker Josh Tickell, offers a different perspective. Tickell recently completed a documentary film titled Freedom that presents ethanol as a solution to this country's reliance on fossil fuels. We ask him how his thinking on this subject changed so dramatically since his last highly acclaimed documentary, Fuel, and find out more about why he believes in ethanol's potential as a clean alternative. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is filmmaker Josh Tickell. He is the director of the award-winning film Fuel, and his latest film is Freedom. Josh, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about the genesis of Freedom, how it sprung from your last film, Fuel, and maybe give our listeners a quick thumbnail sketch of what Fuel was all about.
Sure. The Fuel film is really about my struggle to come from the bayous of Louisiana, growing up in the oil refining sector of Louisiana, Cancer Alley, as it's known, to find an alternative fuel. And what I settled on in the movie is biodiesel. So the movie Fuel follows that 10-year journey that I took looking into biodiesel, promoting it, writing about it, learning about it, and follows it sort of to the conclusion, which was, at the time, just the beginning of the biofuels backlash. It's what we call the media backlash against biodiesel and ethanol. Well, that's kind of where Fuel left off. Freedom picks up where Fuel left off, and Freedom picks up with that biofuels backlash and shows that it was, in fact, funded in part by the oil industry, in part by people who want to keep food prices high. And those two groups worked together to ensure that Americans believed that biofuels were bad. And, of course, the reality is biofuels are the only thing you can put in your tank of the car you drive today. So Freedom really takes a hard look at ethanol, specifically alcohol fuel, and says, well, since we have, 240 million vehicles on the road in North America, and all of them, at least the passenger cars, are gasoline, with the exception of maybe 1 or 2% that are diesel, what are we going to do about these cars? Because they're not going anywhere, especially with a recession and a depression coming for America. What are we going to put in the gas tank? We're just going to keep putting oil and pretend that oil is not the problem that's caused our economic downfall? And the answer is, well, no, there's another option. And that other option is called ethanol. So we really investigate that, break the myths that people have and that the oil industry has propagated against ethanol, and we showed some pretty amazing solutions.
One of the more fascinating parts of the film was there is both left and right are throwing up their hands and protesting expansion of ethanol. And so this has people like yourself who believes that ethanol is an important piece of our energy future scratching their heads. Can you elucidate a little bit on that?
Well, I think what we've seen is, the backlash against biofuels was effective. It reached politics, it reached media, and it reached environmental groups. And it did so through a very systematic dissection of the left, primarily the left. It used the left as its weapon. And it said, what's important to the left? Well, the environment is, and starvation and poverty and rainforest depletion. Great, we'll blame all of that stuff on biofuels. We'll create some white papers. We'll fund some science. And all of a sudden, you've got an easily manipulatable large group of people, which happens when you have, you know, uneducated or misinformed people about any issue. This just happens to be a very strategic use of group of people against themselves. So essentially, that backlash took place because the oil industry largely funded two scientists, or rather an attorney and a scientist. They funded an attorney who's got ties to the coal industry, and they funded a scientist who has ties to the oil industry, neither of whom will publish the funding sources for their papers. And those papers became the foundation for the justification that biofuels were bad. Now, none of the journals that listed the information from those studies peer-reviewed them. They were never dissected. They were never, no other voice was ever heard against that information. They just took it as law. So suddenly you had over 600 major media outlets, including Time, including Newsweek, including The Economist, all jumping on the same bandwagon. And you know something's up when you look at these magazines, and especially in The Economist, and you see quite a bit in Newsweek, you see quite a bit in Time, and even National Geographic, large, full-page, full-bleed ads touting the good deeds that oil companies are doing around the world. So he who pays the advertising bill pays the printing bill. These magazines are not going to turn around and bite the hand that feeds them. And this is essentially the mechanism, the dual mechanism that was used, A, scientific justification, B, money, to ensure that the media took the story hook, line, and sinker, and that the left bought it. And it was very effective. And that's why we saw people on the left and eventually people on the right accusing biofuels of the world's ills. Whereas the reality is almost half the U.S. GDP is dedicated to oil. That's a significant percentage of what we're doing in this country. If you took that money away from big oil, not only would the economy radically shift, we would employ millions of people, but you would radically shift that market called oil and oil co-products. And that's the biggest fear of the oil companies that have a stranglehold over the economy and the government of this country.
Josh, you do a good job of trying to explain a very complicated political and social and economic web in the film. But just to take it one step further and make it even more complicated, one thing you don't talk a lot about is the small versus large farmers and the role of big agriculture and petroleum-based fertilizers and the role that maybe oil and gas plays in our agriculture.
Yes. Yeah, we don't go into that a lot in Freedom, as you said. And the reason we don't go into it is because I feel that it's better covered in other films. We actually cut a large section together about these issues, and we found that we had replicated what Food Inc. and King Korn say very eloquently. So I always say, you know, people say, well, your film doesn't cover this, your film doesn't cover that. I say, well, you know, if you go to the iTunes store, the Netflix rental portal, and you say, I'd like to watch a documentary on this issue, there's a rainbow of docs. What's missing is docs that are actually about solutions. So the Freedom film is ultimately about a solution, and it doesn't go into the depths that King Korn or Food Inc. goes into about what we, you know, what the progressive, you know, left is calling big ag. You know, one distinction that we do make in the Freedom film is that this is a David and Goliath story. And in the way we frame the story, in the way we see the story in the film, David is the farmer. And we actually go find a farmer, and his name's David, ironically. And his name's David Gillen. He's a third-generation farmer in South Dakota. Like most of the farmers in the Midwest, he owns his own land. Like most of them, he's working to find ways to depend less on the Monsantos. The farmers know that the more money they put into those companies' hands, the less power the farmers have, the more dependent they are, the more they have to follow the rules and regulations that come with the seeds and the fertilizers. So what I'm seeing, at least in investigating Middle America, which is where, you know, again, you don't see a lot of coastal reporters traveling into the Midwest and spending months and months there. but and a lot of people who criticize agriculture have never been to an American farm. So what I'm seeing in actually going to these places and actually spending time with these people is that farmers are using their own information that they're gaining from their agronomy, from the sciences, from local universities to do no-till or low-till, meaning they're not tilling the soil as much. They know when they till the soil, it's going to require more fertilizer. You're going to have to rebuild the organic matter. I'm seeing less use of pesticides and fertilizers down to minuscule amounts compared to what quote-unquote big ag tells them they have to do. And I'm seeing a revolution in seeds. A lot of farmers are looking again at organic seeds, even in the 10 to 30,000 to 50,000 acre farms.
And even in number two corn, this industrial corn that can be used for ethanol?
Even in maize, yeah, what we're calling, what's really called maize. It's not human food. It's corn, but it's not edible by humans. So we're seeing even farmers looking at maize organically grown, because ultimately they're finding ways to make it cheaper for them, better for the soil, and the farmers, most of their objectives is to pass on the farm, as most of them have inherited the farm. These are the survivors, by the way. Less than 5% of Americans make our food, as opposed to 1950 when we had almost 50% of the country making our food. So we've had a radical decrease in the number of farmers, a radical increase in the amount of land that each one has to manage, but they're hyper aware of the soil. They're hyper aware of how big ag is playing them. And they're hyper aware of the fact that mostly when they reach out to the environmental movement, what they get back is noise and resistance. And from my conversations, which have extended, you know, well beyond the year or two it took to make the film, I've been in this, you know, investigation for 8 or 10 years. What I find with the American farmer as a generalization is that they are interested in the future of America, that they can think at the microscopic level and they can think at the macro level, and that they're very pragmatic, because at the end of the day, they realize that if they don't farm that acreage and if they're losing money, they'll lose the land, and that it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and more under the control of these companies. And in general, that's not what they want. So, you know, one of the issues that we don't get into in the film, but we talk a lot about in interviews, is the disconnect between the left and the farmers, and the perception from the left that farmers are big ag and big ag is farmers. And we always say farmers are not big ag and big ag is not farmers. They're connected, but they're connected in much the same way that you and I are part of big oil.
My life, so I bought my lid. Even messing with my children and just screaming at my wife. Get off of my bed if you want to get out of here alive. Freedom, that's what I want now. Freedom, that's what I need now. Freedom to live.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is filmmaker Josh Tickell. His latest film is Freedom. People can find it at thefreedomfilm.com. You don't mention in the film anything about the food shortage being blamed on commodity index funds. I don't know if you're familiar with the Goldman Sachs index funds that were created in the 90s that then went through the roof in 2008. We had a guest, Frederick Kaufman, on last year who wrote an interesting piece in Harper's about the real cost of wheat and how it all got thrown out of whack by these commodity index funds. Do you lump these players in that same vat in terms of the actors who are trying to disparage ethanol's future, or is this something that you intentionally didn't cover in the film?
No, we didn't cover it in the film because it's complicated and it's a difficult issue to cover, you know, with an entertainment or documentary piece. But essentially, the commodities price index and the people who push it back and forth and push it up, some of those people are associated with the petroleum industry. And of course, you know, if you have a petroleum industry that's threatened by a fuel grown in America, the way to distort the market would be to push up the future price of grain. That would ensure that that whole market for biofuel goes haywire. And that's essentially what's happened. We've seen the commodities traders push up the, you know, inflated the price of corn and other things with the specific purpose of destroying that market. So we know, you know, very well that it doesn't take a lot of oil money to buy a lot of grain, and the result would be, you know, haywire, which is what we've seen.
The perfect can't be the enemy of the good is one of the things that one of the people in your film talks about, and granted, ethanol is definitely not perfect. I'd be interested, though, in your personal journey in becoming a little more what some people may view as pragmatic, and you probably look at this as a pragmatic solution as opposed to 5-6 years ago when you may not have been on board with ethanol either.
Yeah, no, I mean, 5 or 6 years ago, I was very anti-ethanol. And the reality is 5 or 6 years ago, and let's go back 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we had two significant windows of opportunity, both of which I feel have been passed to some degree. The first of which was the electric vehicle window, which was opened in California and started to spread to other states. And, you know, you can watch Who Killed the Electric Cars, I'm sure a number of your listeners have, to really see the dynamics that crushed that window of opportunity. And it was a powerful time because the capital investment that was available was so liquid. There was so much money, both at the state level, the federal level, and the private level, to move that industry forward. And that was a significant closure of that window of opportunity. That capital investment is gone today. That capital is not available.
And I'm guessing the other one is the capital that got blown up in the hills of Kabul and in Iraq.
Well, that's certainly where it went. You know, we're just look. Every Patriot missile is a subsidy for oil.
That's right.
You know, every mile that aircraft carrier goes across the ocean to protect the sea lanes, so that oil can travel through the Straits of Hormuz back here to, you know, to Long Beach. That's an oil subsidy. So yes, that's where the capital went. The second window that we lost was the window for biodiesel. And there was a significant amount of capital, media support, public support, political support, and that window has now closed. So we've had two significant windows in the past decade that have opened and closed, and largely closed due to public acquiescence. This is the third window, and this, in my opinion, is the last window before the Depression. So, you know, the reason we made freedom and the reason we're having this conversation is because we no longer have the luxury of whining about corn and, you know, the minuscule subsidy in comparison to the oil subsidy that farmers get. We no longer have that luxury. If you look economically at what's happening to our country, if you look at underemployment and unemployment, if you look at the Dow, you look at the dollar, if you look at China, India, Russia, and Brazil forming their own trading currency and moving completely off the dollar, you are looking at a ticking time bomb. So it is a matter of time before the U.S. economy collapses. This is our last chance to get off of oil. We don't take the chance. It's okay. Life will go on. But America, in 2 or 3 years, maybe 5 years, will look a lot like Mexico did 10 years ago. And that's a very scary future. But that's, economically speaking, exactly where we're headed.
We've got 1,000 points of light. Machine gun hand. We got department stores and toilet paper, styrofoam garbage for the ozone layer. Got a man of the people, says people for life. Got fuel to burn, got roads to drive. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is filmmaker Josh Tickell. Josh, there's a poignant scene in the film where you do the math and you break down everything until the final 20 billion gallons of gasoline that we need to make up in our supply chain. Can you give a thumbnail overview for our listeners of how that, how you break that down?
Yes. When Stephen Chu first came into the position of Secretary of Energy under Obama, he had a very clear vision for cellulosic, what's called cellulosic ethanol, making ethanol from grasses, waste, yard clippings, trash, all of that, that whole genre of material. And basically, they did the numbers, the DOE did the numbers, and they said, look, we can make 60 billion gallons safely. We're safe saying we can make 60 billion gallons, one half of the United States fuel today, not counting hybrids, not counting efficiency, not counting lowering your consumption, which are all good things. We can make 60 billion gallons in a very short period of time. You know, by the end of this first leg of this administration, we could be making half of our fuel from cellulosic ethanol. And they did massive studies and massive PR around this. And the DOE was extremely bullish on it until, you know, it came back around that the banks had to be bailed out, and that's where we were going to put our money. So instead of doing what would have been the largest job creation program in recent history, instead of cutting oil imports completely, instead of doing away with this Keystone XL pipeline, you know, tar sands nonsense, we funded the banks that were funded by the oil companies. That one move was detrimental to the future of this country, because that one move was so supported by science. It was so literally thought through on a state-by-state, town-by-town, gas-pump-by-gas-pump level, that it was really the Obama administration's chance to shine. They chose not to do it. But that 60 billion gallons is just the start. If you look forward just a few more years in the future and you start to diversify some of the crops that we're currently selling onto the market that largely make young kids obese and that largely, you know, proliferate non-nutritious types of foods, you could start to replace some of the wheat and corn acreage around the United States with hemp. That provides a very strong fiber base and a very strong protein base. You could even continue to feed some of it to cattle if need be. That incredible transition would provide us with a massive influx of cellulose and could provide another 30 or 40 billion gallons. Once you use the 400 billion tons of waste that we produce in the U.S. and convert some of that to alcohol fuel, you're right about at 100 billion gallons, which means we have to replace 20 billion gallons. And everyone knows we could drive one day a week less. We could have a let's get America back to work program to conserve a little bit, consume a little bit less, and radically boost the economy. That is completely possible. This entire vision is possible within a 5 to 6 year period of time. And what's amazing is it was on the books in the DOE, it's part of what we elected Obama under, and it did not happen. So it can still happen, but it's going to have to happen not by waiting for a savior, but by literally us putting one foot in front of the other as citizens, demanding that ethanol be served at our gas stations, creating the demand so that the supply side can catch up, so that they can build the facilities where they need to be built. And that's what we've got to do. And sort of that's what freedom is about, making a choice. It's an imperfect choice to get to a much better future rather than doing nothing, which is what we're doing today.
And on a tank-by-tank basis, break down the difference between like E5, E15, and E85. And I couldn't help but wonder, why can't we have E100?
Well, E100 is straight alcohol. E85 has 15% gasoline, 85% ethanol. E50 is 50-50, 50% gasoline, 50% ethanol. And E30 is 30% ethanol, 70% gasoline. The idea, of course, is to use a higher blend to get us off of oil. In Brazil, they use E100. It's 100% alcohol. It's everywhere. The cars run on it just fine. Department of Tobacco and Firearms the issue in America is E100 is drinkable. It's 200 proof alcohol.
And this was one of the reasons, and you go back in the film and talk about how ethanol got squashed by John D. Rockefeller and other people by lumping it into the prohibition on alcohol in the from, was it 1919 to the early 30s?
Yes. Yeah. You know, in America, we have tremendous fears of people drinking gasoline. So we denature it, and that keeps the oil companies, of course, in control of the blending. And as long as they're in control of the blending, they kind of control the fuel, too.
So you don't have people literally guzzling gas from the gas pumps.
That, of course, would be terrible. So, you know, there's a lot of issues with that. Do I think we could go to E90 or at least E95, somewhere in there? Yeah, absolutely, we could do that. And hopefully we will. But again, it's demand-based. So, you know, the reality is all of this, of course, started with John D. Rockefeller funding prohibition to shut down the manufacture and sale of alcohol, including alcohol for cars. And the interesting thing about that is it was all touted as a big religious movement. You know, the women's temperance movement didn't want all these drunk people. And the reality is it had nothing to do with that. They just co-opted a religious movement, funded it, used it against itself, and destroyed ethanol fuel. That's what prohibition was about, and it was very successful, and it's still successful. We just see it in a different form today.
It seems like the quote-unquote myth or the conspiracy continues to be perpetuated, and that most people still believe that ethanol led to the food shortages in 2008 and is not a solution. Was that one of the problems with getting more left-leaning and progressive politicians and policymakers on in your film? Because you have Jason Mraz and Egg Begley Jr., who are pretty prominently featured, but they're actors and musicians or artists. And then you have Newt Gingrich and Bud McFarlane and James Woolsey, who are some of the more, who are definitely not considered progressive politicians by any means. But those are the political voices that agreed to come on the film. Was there a problem trying to get more liberal-leaning people to speak in favor of ethanol?
Was there a problem? We didn't really go after a lot of liberal people for the movie simply because we were clear that in Fuel we had sort of the effect of, oh, it's a left-leaning movie and all you leftist sort of hippies are promoting biodiesel. That makes sense. And with this one, we really wanted, with Freedom, you know, the Freedom film, thefreedomfilm.com, we wanted to show people, look, there's support on both sides of the aisle. And that's why we went off after a lot of sort of more right or centrist people to be in the Freedom film.
Yeah, you show a clip of Senator Chuck Schumer going after the oil and gas lobbyists and executives. And do they really consider a difference of opinion on whether or not we should be funneling money and subsidizing oil and gas to be un-American? One of the more disappointing footnotes of that little piece, which is great, is that in the end, Congress went along with it and continued the pipeline.
Yeah, and of course the pipeline, the irony is, you know, it's the pipeline, it's the Gulf of Mexico, it's the opening California and Florida to drilling. It's not that we're addicted to oil per se. We're completely intrinsically tied into oil as a political tool, and it's a fundraising tool. So if you want to get elected, you pretty much got to play with big oil. So it goes to the root of what we think the Republic is supposed to do versus what it really does. And as long as you have no choice, you know, you really have no freedom. And that's why Freedom is called Freedom, because we wanted to make sure we made a movie that gave people choices.
Josh Tickell, filmmaker. His latest film is Freedom. People can find it at thefreedomfilm.com. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for a great and engaging interview.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Eddie Harris, Jimi Hendrix, and Neil Young. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.